It's just like,
it's just not as fun. So
this is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was John Doe.
It's like the argument about the argument in part.
It's Tuesday, December 20th, and you're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. On today's show, we'll hear from local activists with Occupy Peoria movement and the week-long sustained occupation at Fulton Plaza that they pulled off. Also, we'll hear from Occupy Blono with their ongoing occupation. Also, we'll have audio from Occupy Springfield, where Dr. Richard Gilman talks about revolution and insurrection. So stay tuned to Solidarity Journal on the front lines of radio resistance. Listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I am your host, Michael Perillo. Recently, Occupy Peoria occupied Fulton Plaza for 24 hours a day for one whole week. Though it didn't last longer, and the numbers rarely reached up in the teens, it was a good start and way to engage in dialogue with random strangers walking by on the way to work or class. While I was there, I spoke to a few of the individuals that stayed overnight or during the day. On the first night, Zach spoke to me in short on why he was there.
I'm participating in the Occupy Peoria movement because I feel like it's time for myself to stand up and do something about the problems I see facing our country today.
If I gotta go be cold for a little while, I think that's not that big of a sacrifice, man.
Being cold, there's a lot worse things that can happen to you.
Right.
Just being cold, you can be
cold and hungry.
Yeah, you could never have no place to go to get warm.
Karloff was another occupier that told his struggle of getting a job and what he looked forward to with the Occupy movement.
And on a corner with a sign, or 10 people on a corner with a sign.
Right.
That's why this whole perspective right here is more appealing to me. Simply because it's more than just people on a corner with a sign, because it's so easy for the passerby to see people on a corner with a sign as just some kooks or just some conspiracy theorists with falsities. But when you actually have people spending time to come to a place as if it were their job, it means a lot more to somebody that might be just passing by.
The people that go past here are just going to get more and more used to it. The more they see people down here trying to make a point, as long as nobody's getting hurt, it's hard for people to get used to. They see something they're not used to. There's rejection. Everybody has a little rejection when there's change. But I mean, that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to make change. It's what it's all about, man. That's really the purpose I know I get out of it.
There was also John, who told me that there needs to be more accountability for those who have caused the problems he sees with this country.
Yeah, there's a point where you can't be innocent about what you're doing anymore. And you have to either quit it or sabotage it like that guy was doing to come down and you know, support the opposition to it. There's a point where you got to be accountable for what you do. Whether you're a banker or a cop or even just somebody who works and pays taxes.
Nathan, one of the occupiers, explained his feelings and experiences in regards to Occupy Peoria and the occupation itself.
The people in this city, the very few at least, that wanted to be heard or that had an opinion and were willing to stand up for it, that had a view. And everybody kind of came together, and I saw this, And I paid no attention to it at first. I pretty much just kind of pushed it off, like, they're going to do it about 2 days, and they're going to get tired because of the weather. Then, what was it, probably 4 days in, I saw that people were still there. They were still occupying 24/7. It's like, okay, I need to go see. Made my way down there, just strolled by, just to have some words, shake a few hands, see what people thought of the whole thing. And instead of catching the next bus home, I spent the next 2 days at the site. It should give you a little idea of how strongly the entire bond between everybody there was, which really shocked me, considering we couldn't get a dozen people. Really sad, but now that I think about it, a lot of the people that would want to occupy have moved on to the larger cities where there's larger occupations, just trying to be part of a larger voice. Either they've moved down to Springfield, or they're going to Bloomington, or they're going to Chicago, and I think it's really time that everybody in the state that is part of the movement kind of come together and see if we can't be seen and heard everywhere, as opposed to just these larger cities. You know, Peoria doesn't make things happen in the state of Illinois. Springfield does. So I can understand people wanting to go there, but Peoria is where the rich people retreat. This is their hideout. You know, if you want to stay in their face, this is where we need to be. If you want to constantly be heard, go where they vacation. You want to constantly be seen, go where they spend their recreational time and dollars. Don't give them a chance to retreat.
Nathan spoke of his frustration of being down at the occupation and only having a few people standing with him or paying attention.
But to be standing near one of the busier intersections in Peoria, people just walking by, mobs of people. There's probably 75, 80 people around within earshot of me, and there was three of us occupying. And I just started looking at the entire crowd, and I threw my arms out, and I said, why? Why? Why is there only three of us? How can there only be three people at this movement? This is sad. Do people not care? Why? 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 And I just started shouting it to the entire intersection, and everybody's heads turned and looked at me, and I didn't expect it. I just broke down crying. I don't know what it was. It just hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, that hurt. But what really made that entire moment kind of profound was the fact that an African-American gentleman turned the corner, pulled over, ran up and hugged me, and said, "Sir, you feel exactly how Dr. King felt." And that blew my mind. I couldn't put words to it. I still really can't. I don't even know how to describe it to this day. It was just this amazing, almost powerful feeling that just kind of coursed through me, and it pretty much married me to the movement at that point. Because I realized that it wasn't just pushing my ideas, it was pushing my body, it was pushing my emotions, it was pushing my thought processes. Mm-hmm. And it was forcing me to wake up for the first time in 10 years. And doing so, I guess, I was looking around and it was making me sick that nobody else was doing it with me. They need to mob up, for lack of a better term. We need heads. We need people. We need bodies. We need people willing to be heard, willing to hold signs, willing to put those nights in, those days in.
Another person named Shannon was also down at the occupation in Fulton Plaza. A taxi driver at night, he would first frequent the site and talk with the protesters, and would offer warmth in his cab. Eventually, he decided to stand out there and join.
Well, been an activist for many years, and I knew about the occupation of Peoria before, of course, because of the website. You know, I'm friends with a good percentage of people in the area, and I've seen the link several times. So, you know, I knew I would end up down there regardless. You know, I first started coming down there just to show support and give advice from my past experiences. I did, of course, after being down there, hanging out there in the cab, you know, trying to help out, doing what I could. I seen that, you know, it was a lack of people to be down there. You know, I figured nothing else, be able to have an extra man down there. Started meeting some of the people, ended up meeting some good people down there. And, you know, I just figured I'd join in. You know, the big thing is I really expected more of a showing. But, to me it's one of those, it's the thought that counts. It's hard in the Peoria area to get people to step up. It is really hard. I've been trying to do it for years on other issues that I'm involved in. And it's just next to impossible. Unless you show them something that they're going to get in return, you know, It's just next to impossible to get these people in the Peoria area to step up and join. And they want something that's more organized. They want somebody, a face, stepping up saying this is it.
Shannon also pointed out that aside from the cold winter, people work multiple jobs, which might deter quite a few people away from participating.
There's some people down there that's got two jobs that's down there every night. People that work all day, then they come down and hang out all night. That's true stuff there. That's good stuff for them to be doing that. I put in the time that I could put in, as long as I could put in.
Another person who occupied Fulton Plaza was Joey. He discussed with me over the phone what got him involved in the first place.
Just became politically aware 3 years ago with the birth of my daughter, more or less looking out for her future. Started with education, child development, all that. And then I just came across, I've always said the politicians don't work for us, they work for them. Me personally, I think the root problem is the Federal Reserve, the money, and that's not political at all. That's our currency run by a private bank. So.
He also spoke of one person who worked for the city that confronted him and asked him why he was out there at 4 a.m. occupying Fulton Plaza.
First words out of his mouth is, hey, you guys are up there urinating, defecating, raping, doing drugs, all that stuff. And, he sat and talked to us like a half hour. And by the end of it, we all had the same grievances, just a little bit different solutions, but we all know what the root problems are, and we understand what they are. And that's where we got to start to work to change, I guess.
Joey also had some critiques of the movement in the local area and why the occupation wasn't bigger.
I think the only reason, the real reason why nothing's really taken off here, as people just camped out and been camping out, was the daily direct actions. You see that a lot with other places, especially big cities, but even like occupying weekly City Hall, any chance we could have got with Aaron Schock coming here, Bloomington, head down to Springfield. More of those would have drawn more attention and more people out just to see what it's all about. And then on the flip side, we're out doing the outreach, the teach-ins, community service, the positive things. We're not doing day-to-day things.
Recently in Occupy Blono, an affiliate from the New York Times came down from Chicago to report and post pictures of the encampment, which was the second longest standing occupation in the nation. Recently, though, individuals destroyed the encampment during the night, but then was soon put back up. I spoke to Tyler, one of the occupiers, about what had happened.
Around 9 or 10 o'clock came into camp when no one happened to be here at that time. It is finals week and whatnot here at ISU. And they flattened three of the tents. They broke some of the support stakes, rods, the support rods in the tent. They found kitty litter and basically dumped out a bunch of it in most of the tents except for the kitchen tent. They also tore down signs. We are missing at least one conga drum and the vast majority of our signs. We found extension cords of ours strewn in tree branches not too far from the occupation site. They poured out Listerine and soap in our big tent. They dumped out a large amount of bagels that had been donated to us in our kitchen tent, as well as dumped a very large jug of water all inside that tent.
Tyler also talked about what the encampment would be doing with winter around the corner, direct action, and other things like the performance they did in regards to the indefinite detention provisions in the NDAA bill. He also talked a little bit about the move. The possibility of the move wasn't talked about because of the recent vandalism, since it was talked about a week prior to that.
With winter coming, the plan for the move is a shutdown business. I think it's very symbolic. We've seen more and more in this country that we are losing jobs, we're losing industry, and I feel personally, and I the consensus too, for the most part from what I've seen, is that it's very symbolic that we essentially are occupying business or industry, and occupying industry by moving the camp. We definitely acknowledge the fact that it's hard to keep morale and motivation up. The cold weather does a lot to demotivate people as well as it just takes your energy away. Being out here for too long, the exposure to the elements, it's a very tiring thing. So we're kind of adopting the attitude now that it's fairly obvious that the best way to keep morale up is by continuing direct action. The direct action we carried out on Thursday was freaking sweet. It got people pumped. Morale was definitely high. And I definitely will not say that the vandalism destroyed morale whatsoever. If anything, it just pissed us off even more. Not that we're pissed off inherently, but it aroused our passions, evoked our passions to want to continue this whole thing. And over the winter, those of us that are staying, those of us that live in the area that are staying and not going back to our respective homes outside of the city, the community, are going to adopt a policy of carrying out more actions to keep that fire burning.
You're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica radio affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo. Now we'll hear from Dr. Richard Gilman, who recently was in Occupy Springfield, Illinois, giving a speech on revolution and insurrection.
When you ask revolutionaries, you know they give you different answers, that revolutionaries don't all have the same sense of what ought to be. Some revolutionaries have no answer to the question at all because, you know, they have seen a long line of men with answers of how things will look after the revolution. And those men, the 20th century has told us, oftentimes turn out to be the most dangerous ones, the ones that we probably should be more suspicious of than excited about. Some revolutionaries only know that the present state of affairs is immoral. It is intolerable, and that it must be opposed. And the first thing I want to suggest is that we should never take for granted the importance of a moral condemnation of the existing state of affairs, because it is not something that you can just take for granted. It is not everywhere around you. It is not always the case that everyone makes a moral condemnation of the existing state of affairs. So when you start to see one emerge, don't get so worried so quickly that there isn't some shared vision of how it ought to be. We cannot predict how things will go, whether or not the occupations will take on a more insurrectionary turn, or whether or not these energies will be channeled into procedural politics in the election cycle. My fear, and I have no reason to think it will definitely happen, but my fear is that the energies that bring you here, the energies that bring you to drop a banner, the energies that bring people into the streets to occupy bank lobbies, that those energies will be channeled into an election cycle. That is my fear. I don't think, however, that even if this happens, and if the occupations seem to dissipate and go away for some time, that their reemergence is unlikely. In fact, I think that these occupations are already a reemergence of earlier energies. Okay? I think these occupations are themselves, they did not begin on Wall Street. Okay? And they did not begin in the Arab Spring. There were occupations in 2008 in Greece that have not stopped in response to that crisis. There were occupations in 1968 in France. There were occupations in 1968 in the United States. And I have to say that I don't downplay the importance of this moment for us historically, because It is the first time since 1968 that for months on end, people in this country are talking about capitalism. And we need to have a conversation not only about revolution, but we need to have a conversation about capitalism. Those who are asking with feigned concern for the purposes of the occupations will never be gratified with a clear answer. They don't even want one. They don't want an answer to why we occupy. They ask, but they do not want. Doesn't reflect a position of solidarity, the question. Notice the question does not reflect, does not embody a position of solidarity. They prefer to point out the absence of a plan or to have one finally at long last in order to reject it. Media commentators, which you should always take in small doses, cannot understand that such clarity of purpose is not desirable from an insurrectionary perspective. From an insurrectionary perspective, we understand, I think, that the energies of everyday people, when they fracture and they break up the repressive conditions of everyday life, they are not meant to be clearly grasped. These energies are meant to be obscurely beyond anyone's grasp. I'd like to take this farther. We should never, I propose, conceive of and defend ideal end states. I love to read the utopian visions of anarchists. Some of my favorite books contain those visions, but the time for utopian visions is over. There are many reasons for this, I think. Some of them are historical. Others are just a matter of principle. One of the worst things that has happened to revolutionary movements is that after the revolution, they claimed themselves to be the end of revolution. For now, let us just observe that every state of affairs can be better. And to dream of an ideal end is to dream of the end of revolution. Let us dream instead of the beginnings, not the ends, of revolution. Now, some may wonder, why revolution? And this perhaps could be the conversation that we'll open up onto, is an open conversation of why revolution. Not everybody in the occupations or in solidarity with the occupations, some of you may participate in some way, is interested in the question of revolution. Some say it is impractical. You know, when I hear people saying that revolution is impractical because all we have to do is take money out of elections, I wonder who's the dreamer. When I hear people say, why are you talking about revolution? All we need to do is elect somebody new. I think they are the dreamer. They have an impractical plan. I've never heard anything less practical than that proposal. Well, why revolution can be answered? Why revolution can be answered in a very simple way? Because we object to the existing conditions. Because we have an understanding of the macroeconomic reality. We can look at it from the most conservative sources. The OECD tells us, an organization of free market people, how income inequality in the United States is greater than anywhere except for in Chile and Mexico. We can look at the UNDP, the reports that come out of the United Nations, and we have an understanding of this macroeconomic reality, which is increasingly bleak for most of the world's people. We understand also alienation. We also understand the alienation and delirium of everyday life, among other problems, included but not limited to sexist, racist, ecological, and we can continue and add to the list. Can the current expression of disaffection that is taking the form of occupations, can it be fully gratified within the limits of capitalism? I think not. I think whatever happens in the coming months, or year, I do not think that the generalized disaffection that is now being expressed can be gratified within the limits of capitalism. Capitalists have been speaking of a fair capitalist society since the 18th century. When we didn't even have mass production coming up yet. It was the late 18th century. It was late 18th century when we started to see the beginnings of the 100 years known as the Industrial Revolution, the period of industrialization. And you know, Marx was watching this around the time that the term was coined, Industrial Revolution, and he came up with a word for these people who always spoke about fair capitalist society. He called them apologists. And he called their discourse the discourse of apologetics, by which he meant that for them, it had nothing to do with the political economic structure of society. There's a bad apple. And was Marx some old dead man who should... Well, haven't you heard who's responsible for the economic crisis today? Ben Bernanke. One man, a villain. No, of course, the economic system can have no causal relationship to the economic crisis, right? It's just a bad apple. Ben Bernanke, yes? Barney Frank did it. That's the man who did it. Yes, the economic crisis is caused by a person who wears pants. This is, if I dare say, you know what it is. Okay? This is apologetics. And apologetics has existed since the 18th century. And there was a form of apologetics for every setback of free labor. But now we have roughly 250 years of hindsight. And with roughly 250 years of hindsight and growing disparities around the globe, it is perhaps time for us finally to acknowledge the possibility that all meaningful conceptions of fairness will either impede or directly contradict with the logic of capital. The logic of capitalism. There is a very simple way of defining the logic of capitalism, and capitalists all agree. It is to accumulate capital. If you find a person who is not interested in the accumulation of capital, then they do not call themselves capitalists. It is an irreducible part of the etymological and conceptual history of the word capitalism that its logic means the accumulation of capital. And when you find capitalists who don't accumulate capital but lose it, political scientists, we have a technical term for them. We call them not very good capitalists. Because very good capitalists accumulate it. That's what they do. The logic of capitalism is to accumulate capital. This is non-controversial. Certainly, in capitalist societies like ours, fairness exists in gradations. Of course, there is more or less fairness in different capitalist societies. And of course, if we live in one, we should want more rather than less fairness. We should perhaps even fight for it. There is sometimes, even in the same capitalist society, different parts of the society that are more or less fair. But if we work toward optimal fairness, if we are really interested in fairness and optimizing fairness, it is only a matter of time. It is only a matter of time before we run up against the logic of capital itself. Endless accumulation, now more than ever, is the heart of capitalism, since we've seen, since the late 80s, a program of policy deregulation from GATT to NAFTA to the World Trade Organization to the FTAA to the CAFTA. It goes on and on and on. This neoliberal regime is not... The interesting thing in our society is that the neoconservatives are also neoliberals. Endless accumulation follows a different logic, the logic of growth and private ownership and wealth, than the logic of fairness. The logic of fairness is centered on equality and the common good. Finally now, well over 20 years after the Cold War has come to an end, It should now be non-controversial to observe that most of the world's formal institutions of power are capitalist. Even the ones that the press in the US calls socialist are capitalist. There were socialist philosophers who spoke of the Soviet Union in the 1940s as capitalist. In the 1940s, they called it bureaucratic capitalism. They called it bureaucratic capitalism in the Soviet Union, and what we had was free market capitalism. So we can no longer pretend that capitalism has nothing to do with present global miseries. And in this room, I am glad to say that it doesn't have to be made a long-winded argument. When I went to the Occupy demonstration, I saw signs that had the word capitalism on them, which in the US is very important. Don't underestimate the importance of this emergence and this moment. The occupations, I think, this is why as a philosopher I would never make recommendations to social movements. As a philosopher, I look at social movements and I allow them to advise me. Good philosophers, I think, I hope, learn from social movements. They don't teach social movements. The teaching is the other way. It is the occupations, not the political philosophy, that criticizes capitalism. It is the occupations that have forced a return to the question of capitalism in this country for the first time since the late 1960s. A revolutionary perspective is indispensable because it does not only observe the catastrophe of existing conditions, and it does not only condemn them. A revolutionary perspective insists on obliterating the conditions that give rise to the inequalities we address.
For listening to this week's show of Solidarity Journal. I'd like to thank all of those who put the time, effort, and interest into Occupy Peoria's and Occupy Blono's occupations this past month and who continue to push forward. Also, thanks to Occupy Springfield for posting the audio on Dr. Richard Gilman and his excellent speech on revolution and insurrection. Remember, you can tune in every Tuesday at 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. to hear more Peoria exposés on Solidarity Journal. And if you miss the shows, you can go to radioforall.org to listen through the archived shows. Also, don't forget to check out wazufm.org. So until next time, keep up the resistance.